Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a very exciting founder turned investor. You know, we're going to be talking about his journey, which is quite remarkable. And again, some of the things, you know, that come, you know, along as part of the journey, you know, whether that is, you know, his transition into venture, you know, what happened with his last company too. And then also the realities of venture capital, venture funds, and some of that misalignment that we see with LPs, no? So again, a really inspiring and exciting conversation that we have in front of us. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Chin and Loy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Alejandro. Really excited to be on.
So originally born and raised in Singapore, give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I always consider myself very fortunate to be born and raised in Singapore. Grew up under, I would say, what people call the tiger parenting construct. So both my parents were in academia. My dad was and still is a university professor. My mom taught Mandarin in middle school pretty much for her entire life. So as you can imagine, since young, academics, doing well in school, getting the A's, super important, right? And kind of like that was pretty much the be all and end all of the first, I would say, 15, 16 years of my life. As with all Singaporean students at 18 years old, the Singapore government has came up with this pretty wonderful scheme of providing full ride scholarships for Singapore students, regardless of your background, to go overseas to pursue your education, right? So it was an entirely meritocratic process. And for me, this was exciting at a point because it was a way to get out of Singapore, right? And also escape from my parents, to be fair. Just got tired of studying, got tired chasing after exam. And so really sort of put my heart into it, got admitted into Stanford, got a full ride government scholarship. But as all Singaporeans have to do, we have to serve military service. So did that for 2 years. And during military service was when I got together with two friends to start what was then just a fun side project. And today it's a Series D company that has raised more than $80 million.
That's amazing. So how did you guys get going with the company? How did that all happen? How did that come together?
You know, sometimes when people ask that, I wish that, you know, I had to say that, you know, I was born knowing that I would do it. But that couldn't be further from the truth, right? It was accidental by many counts. So first and foremost, you know, me and the two other friends, we felt frustrated during military service, right? Sure, we were serving our nation, but we felt like we weren't mentally challenged. And so what we figured out we had to do is to figure out ways to mentally challenge ourselves. Now, who would hire people like 18, 19-year-old folks, zero work experience, and they can't even work office hours, right? They can maybe only work weekday evenings or weekends. As we very quickly turned out and learned, it was startups, right? At that point, the startup scene in Singapore was just taking off, like what we call Generation 1 of startups. And look, these startups at that point weren't able to raise large amounts of funding, and they were happy to take us on, right? They were happy to kind of help get any help that they could. So really, the three of us embarked on startup internships during military service. And we very quickly realized, hey, there's actually quite a lot of startups out there. So we started to connect our friends who were also serving military with those startups. And that's really how Glynn started. Literally serving the two arguably smallest market sizes. One is startups, and the other is, I would say, young, fresh, hungry interns looking to do that. And so that's really sort of Glynn's, right? In fact, the name itself has an interesting story. Of course, the word Glynn's has the connotation of like a star, a shining star, right? And that's sort of what we why we chose it. But the reality of it was Glynn's was actually also a mashup of global internships. So GL from the global and then INT from the internships part, right? So really sort of even the name today pays heritage to how we came about. And really, this was just meant to be a project. We weren't really thinking about building this as a company because, like I said, myself and my two other friends, we actually were on full ride scholarships, ready to go to the US to some of the top universities to study, right? So it was really sort of almost as a fun thing. And then that was when, once again, something coincidental, totally unplanned happened, right? A friend of a friend met us for the first time and said, hey, would you like some money to turn this into a business? And as you can imagine, when you are 18 years old, if someone offers you money, you don't say no, right? And so we took it back. We figured, okay, we need 50K. And then the following week, the angel said, sure, let's get started. And I vividly remember the first question I asked was, how do you incorporate a company? Because that was absolutely like, we just had no idea, right, on how to do all of these things. But that was really sort of how Glints came about.
So what ended up being the business model of Glints? How are you guys making money there?
Yeah, so look, we went through kind of a lot of pivots, a lot of ups and downs. But I think today sort of where Glints is at, it's one of the largest, if not the largest recruitment platform in Southeast Asia, right? The primary revenue source is really true. The traditional, I would say, recruiter employment models, a lot of it, it's a contingency basis. So you give me an available job vacancy. If you fill it, you get paid. Another business line that has taken off very well is what we call employer on record. So being able to set up offices all across Southeast Asia so that companies don't have to, right? Let's say today you want to hire someone from Indonesia, you can do so right away and we'll take care of everything, right? From payroll to tax to social security. So really sort of these are the two key drivers of the business.
And at what point do you guys realize that you guys were turning around a corner?
Yeah, I think it was really, you know, that is really interesting, right? And also that kind of shaped a lot on how I view at least emerging markets, venture ecosystems. I think the biggest lesson we learned is distribution over product, right? In the first few years, we were very obsessed with the idea of product-led growth. We were obsessed with building SaaS, obsessed with the idea of self-serve, right? The idea that someone will pick up a credit card, key in their information, and bam, we'll bill them a couple $100 a month. I think we were trying different ways, different value propositions, but fundamentally, just that behavior didn't work. And I would hazard, I'll go as so far as to say that 10 years down the road, that hasn't actually changed much, right? In a sense that the models that we see that work well in a bit more mature markets, Western markets like the US and Europe, where SaaS is a lot more common for folks who, once again, take a credit card and make payments, doesn't really happen, right? So it's a lot more of a sell-in approach where you need to actively build up your distribution. You need to build up your sales, your marketing channels, and actively sort of canvas potential customers. And really, at the end of the day, people also want to be served. People don't want to self-serve. I think that's sort of one key behavior difference that we have noticed broadly in terms of markets, right? So case in point for us at Glints, when we were charging a couple of $100 for people to access our platform, search for candidates, post their jobs, it was so difficult, right? Like it was really like rolling a rock up a hill. But then the moment we tell them, hey, give me the job, I'll use those tools myself to find you the talent. But if I'm successful, you pay me 20, 25% of annual salary. Like, boom. They were like, sure, take it. And then that was when it was like the aha moment, right? Here I am struggling to get $200-$300 from you. And here, there you are, willing to give me a pretty substantial sum of money if I'm able to use those same tools. But the difference is I do it for you. So really sort of that whole thinking was the big turning point for us in terms of the business.
And what about fundraising? Because obviously the company has raised quite a bit already, but how has it been that journey for the company, especially while you were there, you know, for close to 5 years? How was that like?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's a very much up and down journey, right? And I think that has also shaped a lot on how I view my current job now as an investor. Look, fundraising was very difficult, right? There was just so many cold starts. We were co-emailing, we went to pitch events, we went to conferences to set up booths. Just trying to get the right sort of investors to believe in us. And when we raised sort of our first few rounds, it was very much narrative driven, right? And the narrative was even less about the business. It was really about the founders, right? What we had going for at that point was we were early in the ecosystem. So we were one of the first in Southeast Asia to raise venture at such a young age. And so that got us sort of a lot of, I would say it helped us, right, to gain the attention of other investors. But even then, the business model was tough, exactly for the reasons that I shared, right? Many people felt like, oh, this is not like Amazon, like a social media, like a SaaS platform that could scale 100x. Many people felt like, oh, this is a recruitment business at the end of the day. So finding believers who believed in us, the team, the idea was challenging. But really, at the end of the day, it's almost like the law of large numbers, right? When you put in enough effort, you canvas enough, people and the sincerity comes through, eventually we managed to find our supporters.
What was the turning point there with the supporters?
I think the turning point was really finding people who first believe in us, and then they in turn help us, coach us on how to shape the story so that other investors will come on board, right? And I think to the extent some of our Series A investors were instrumental in the process, because they were just more, they were so much more than investors. They were coaches, right? They saw us as, you know, these young, hungry, but foolish founders. And they really took the effort to spend time with us, walk us through, you know, the pitch deck, walk us through how do you build even a data room? How do you build a financial forecast, right? These are things that we really work together with investors, some of our investors, to build out. So I think really sort of finding those one or two early champions who then really supported us was critical.
So then in terms of the actual, growth of the business, you know, like how were you guys going from like one cycle to the next? How was that journey like too?
Yeah. I think the nice thing about at least our industry was, yes, right? Like exactly. It's not 100x thing, right? It doesn't go 100x overnight. But I think one thing that's quite clear, recruitment is one of those things that you just need on an ongoing basis. Of course, in bull markets, people expand their hiring needs. So there's a lot more sort of volume in that. But even in sort of challenging markets, there's still attrition, right? And people need to find opportunities. So I think generally the business itself is quite resilient against macroeconomic conditions. Sort of the biggest unlock for us was geographical expansion, right? We started in Singapore simply because that was where we're all from and we were all based, but also very quickly realized that Singapore is such a saturated market, such a small market. The inflection point that came was expanding to Indonesia, right? Which is the largest economy in Southeast Asia, 230 million people. So I think really sort of unlocking the market, understanding how it works, and myself, my co-founders would spend more than half of our time in the market to just understand and speak with customers. I think that really was kind of the big unlock for us. And then subsequently, right, even though I had left in 2017, riding the tech boom from 2017 all the way to 2021 definitely helped to catalyze the business.
So what happened there? You know, because eventually, you know, the chapter comes to an end and you decide to transition out of the business. So what led that decision?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, that was a tough moment, and still probably is the lowest moment of my life. I think it came to a point where, in terms of the direction which we wanted to take the business, there was too much creative friction, there was too much disagreement with my co-founders in terms of how we wanted to grow, how we wanted to run the business, to the point that I think we all mutually agreed that it would be better for me to step down, right? And as you can imagine, something that I gave up a lot on, gave up school, gave up scholarship, and I think more importantly also to deal with sort of the pressures back from family around that was quite a lot, right? But, I think that was really sort of a huge learning lesson I had. I think looking back, there's many things I would do differently. I think to really be less, I would say, individualistic, to be a lot more collaborative and open. But look, it was a lesson, a painful one, definitely. But one that I have taken, and I think that's so it wasn't easy at all, right? To basically co-founder disagreement, co-founder separation. But I think, you know, having gone through that, definitely sort of what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So I guess for the people that are listening and also for the some of the companies that you are advising and investing in, what advice do you typically have for them when it comes to co-founder arrangements, co-founder structures, you know, that kind of relationship?
Yeah. Look, I think it's important to be intentional. I think that's really the number one thing, right? Often in the excitement of starting a business, especially if there's a funding offer on the table, it's just tempting to sort of grab whoever who is available, whoever who is most convenient or whoever you know best, right? To kind of work on this. But I think what is very clear, it's just the ability to get to know your founders better, to make sure you're with the right people. Because it's truly like a marriage, right? I think there's no better sort of way of putting it. The amount of time you spend together and all of that. And even now as an investor, right, I've seen situations where the chemistry is awesome between two or three founders, and then when the chemistry just doesn't work, right? So I think taking time to sort of find out whether there is that chemistry between the founders, especially before you take funding, I think that's going to be like the biggest advice, right? Because once you take funding, it becomes a lot more complex, a lot more tricky. There's a lot more voices in the room, sometimes not necessarily best suited for individuals. So really sort of figuring out and taking time to understand who you're working with, I think that's the biggest takeaway.
So then after, you know, Glints, basically you joined BCG, their digital ventures arm, and you were there for about 2 years and a half before you decided that it was time to make the move to the other side of the table. So walk us through because it sounds like it was a pivotal moment for you. So walk us through that transition from BCG to then all of a sudden becoming an investor.
Yeah, absolutely. So I joined BCG because I think at Glints, a lot of our customers back then were small and medium companies, right? And I felt like I had a pretty good grasp on, you know, if you put me in front of a small, medium company owner, I could sell, I could understand them, but I had no experience sort of working with the Fortune 500s, the large corporations. So BCG was a great place to do that, plus combine sort of my founder experience and apply it in a corporate setting. I think that was also right when the bull market was in its full swing, 2019 to 2021, where there were plenty of corporates that were hungry to build ventures. And look, I think it was pretty interesting, right, to kind of go through the zero to one process. So this opportunity to move to the investor side of the table actually came up unintentionally. Once again, a friend of a friend reached out because he was leaving to do his Harvard MBA, asked whether I was interested to join. I was like, why not, right? Let's chat. And honestly, I was very skeptical at the start because it's not just a venture capital fund. It's a Japanese corporate venture capital fund. Right. And sort of having been a founder before, like certain stereotypes come about, right? Firstly, CVCs are generally known to be slow, bureaucratic, and they force partnerships. And then you sort of, if you add the Japanese layer to it, it feels like almost like the worst, right? I remember the first question I asked in my sort of chats with them was, are you going to take 6 months to write a 100K check? Right? Because having been a founder, if that happens, absolutely, you just lose competitiveness. Thankfully, the answer is not. It's one of those, I think, better set up CVCs, which I'm happy to go into more detail, which is why I'm still around. But I think really sort of figuring out that this would be a great platform for me to come back into the ecosystem, support and partner up with founders, especially at the pre-seed and seed. I think that's sort of where my heart is at, because sort of having been through the journey, been through the hard pains of, you know, almost the company almost failing, almost running out of runway, I feel like the experience comes in potentially useful, less from a purely like how to run a company perspective, because I think also, once again, many VCs think that they know how to run companies, which even I don't dare to claim that. But I think really just from a support perspective, right? I want to be the investor I never had.
I hear you. So then that transition to becoming an investor, no? Now, obviously, That's what you're up to. You know, that's what you have been doing now for about close to 3 years with Saison Capital. So how did the opportunity of Saison Capital, you know, come about knocking, and what are you guys doing there?
Yeah. No, look, I think it's really sort of pretty interesting, right? So a bit of background was it's the parent company is Credit Saison, which is the second largest credit card company in Japan. One might wonder, what is a Japanese credit card company doing outside, right? Long story short, 10 years ago, the company expanded out in emerging markets, India, Southeast Asia, and most recently, LATAM, on the debt and equity front. On the equity front, this fund was set up in 2019 to do sort of early stage, right, pre-seed, seed investments. And it's set up to be financially focused, which I think is a very important difference, right? We were set up to make money instead of purely sort of, like, the strategic alignment is optional. So when I heard all of that, I was like, yeah, that makes sense. I think being a financial focused CVC also allows you to move a lot quicker, allows you to take bets that might not necessarily make sense. And that leads to the next question, the answer, right? To the next question, what are we doing? When I joined, that was when I had the first-hand opportunity of setting up our Web3, our digital asset, the early stage fund. And that was a lot of fun for me, right? Because once again, previously, I had only bought Bitcoin as purely as an investment thing. Never thought that there was there's this whole world, right? Web3 applications, use cases, and all. So since then, over the past 3 years, I've been deep diving down the rabbit hole, of course, alongside the non-Web3 side of things, but really sort of a lot of my time, resources has been just to understand, right, the whole world of DeFi, of NFTs, of gaming. So yeah, it's been exciting, right? I don't think we're anywhere close to done, but that's something that we're up to.
So then now, in terms of the types of companies that you look at, you know, what do they look like? How would you break down the investment thesis that you guys have?
Yeah. So what's unique, once again, is we do both direct investments, pre-seed to, I would say, pre-A, but we also do fund of funds. And I think that's one of the good things that actually I saw, right? Because look, I mean, direct investments is what it is, right? I think there's so many VCs out there that have spoken about it. But I think for us, the interesting piece is actually doing fund of fund investments, because it gives me a firsthand understanding of what good, great, and maybe not so good look like, right? So to date, we have reviewed like more than 300 over funds, Web2, Web3, all across the globe, and really sort of helps me to understand, okay, this is how some of the leading venture capitalists think, right? So I think having the access, having that knowledge, having that exposure, it's something that I appreciate a lot. To date, Saison Capital has invested in 15 funds globally, a couple more in the pipeline. So yeah, I think that's one of the things that I have some interesting insights on.
So talk to us about the misalignments there with LPs, you know, founders, you know, all of that stuff. How does that come together?
Yeah. Look, I think the biggest thing when I came into this space is remembering, once again, my founder days. You know, every founder has their own internal ranking and tier, right? Of, you know, where VCs stack up, right? Just like how watches have brands, handbags have different brands that rank differently. I think all startups founders have their own list, right? And often that list of who is tier one, top tier, is somewhat related to fund size, right? More often than not, we would, at least for me in my experience, right, as a founder, I would greatly admire the largest funds, right? You're talking about your billion-dollar global funds, or perhaps in Southeast Asia, your multi-million, like triple-digit million funds, right? And so, kind of when I was at Saison, there was with some funds we invested in, some funds we invested after I joined. And we invested in a whole broad range of funds, right? We invested in, like I said, billion-dollar funds. We also invested in micro funds that are like 10, 20 mil. And what I quickly realized is that brand does not necessarily correlate to performance, right? It was just, and that was shocking to me, right? Because one would think that, okay, with a brand, you would be able to unfairly attract the best founders, right? And therefore, you should have the best performance. But what it really quickly realized, it's that that's not always the case. In fact, it often leads to the opposite outcomes. So what I mean by that, right? It's really about, for these GPs out there, what exactly are you banking on to grow your wealth, to put it bluntly, right? Are you relying on a 2% management fee, or are you relying on a 20% carry? And more often than not, what we see is quite a few fund managers that raise outsized funds especially in Southeast Asia, where like we know for sure there's no way that, you know, such an outcome can be generated, right? So let's just say, for example, any fund that raises above, let's say, 500 million in Southeast Asia would probably need at least 8 or 10 unicorns to kind of return that fund. And the idea of 8 to 10 unicorns, like in Southeast Asia, it's quite challenging, right? And we haven't talked about dilution, the challenge on capital markets and all of that. So then the question is, if you are raising 500 mil, you are making 2% fees every year, maybe that's split among a couple of partners, and that's done over 10 years, mind you, right? It's like, by the time people realize that perhaps your returns aren't great, you'll be fine. You'll be set as a GP, right? And so that was something that was such a huge realization and such a huge, I guess to some extent, awakening for me, right? As compared to the smaller fund managers who are hungry, who are valuation sensitive, right? And because they can't, I mean, they're barely surviving on the 2% fee, right? Let's say you raise a 10 mil, a 20 mil fund that barely covers your OPEX. So you really kind of optimize for the exits. You optimize for the carry, which in turn works well for LPs. So, I mean, of course, I know this is generalization. There are, of course, large funds that also have that. But I think broadly, this pattern of sort of what are your incentives, misaligned incentives really comes out, right? So really, and what happens if you raise two large funds? It's firstly, you don't deliver returns for your LPs. And secondly, you go to founders. And because you have a large fund, if you run a 500 mil fund, look, you can't be writing a 100K check, right? You got to write something larger. You write larger checks, you offer higher prices. And then those companies are forced to grow into those prices. And then in bear markets like this, they struggle. So yeah, like I know I've spoken a lot on this, but I think that's sort of really one of the things that being an LP as well as sort of a, I would say I'm not a GP, right? Because we are CVC, but doing both direct and doing both LP, that is sort of one of the biggest realizations that we have.
So just real quick here, how many investments have you guys done and how big is the amount, I mean, the assets under management that you guys have right now?
Yeah, it's an evergreen fund, but we're slightly more than 150 mil AUM, USD. And we have done slightly more than 100 direct investments, anywhere from 100K check all the way to single digit million, and then 15 fund of funds also.
So if I could bring you back in time and bring you back to that moment where you were now finishing the military service and, you know, you were thinking about like doing something of your own, you know, and becoming an entrepreneur, if you could have a chat with that younger self and give that younger self one piece of advice before launching a business, what would that be and why, given what you know now?
Learn to sell and don't be afraid of selling. I think that's the biggest advice I have learned and I unashamedly share with all the founders I work with. At the point when I started the company, there was a lot of ego, right? And it didn't help that getting all that press, getting all that funding helped inflate the ego. And I think the ego came around to, look, I don't need to sell, right? My product should sell for itself. People should come in and use it because I built such an awesome product. And I think that was, and I refused to sell. And that was when an investor came in to sit the three of us down and say, look, pick up the phone and call the customers. Because if you can't even convince your customers, how are you going to train your team to sell, right? And I will remember picking up the phone very vividly, dialing those, and just praying that the other person on the line wouldn't pick it up. Because I don't want to talk, I don't want to sell, I don't want to do the cold call, I don't want to face rejection, right? And so sort of really going through that hurdle, I still remember it very vividly, right? And that said investor would actually sit us down at the end of the day and say, how many calls did you do, right? And then I would say like 5. And then he said like, you had 8 hours in the day, right? Why do you only do 5 calls? So like, yes, I know it sounds a bit micro, but it really sort of woke us up in terms of building the discipline, building that confidence and the courage to do sales. So today, kind of like, even when I work with founders, and even in the different things that I do, right, like building an events platform, building a digital asset fund, like I'm not afraid to cold call, cold DM, cold message, right? Like to me, that's just the discipline that has been built. I'm not afraid for people to say no. It's fine. It's just a numbers game, right? So sort of really, that's the biggest thing that I would say changed our company's trajectory biggest personal growth also for me, right? To sort of put aside the ego. Because at that point, I was like, you know, I dropped out of Stanford. Right? I didn't drop out of Stanford to make cold calls. Yeah, I mean, of course, I didn't say that out, but that was really sort of what I was thinking, right? But being able to put that aside was truly sort of like the removing that barrier.
So for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
On LinkedIn. LinkedIn is the best, and I respond to most messages there.
Amazing. Well, hey, well, Chin, it has been an absolute honor to have you with us. So thank you so much for taking the time to be on the Dealmaker Show with us, and really, really appreciate every minute.
Thank you so much, Alejandro. Really appreciate the time and the work that you're doing. And for founders out there who are keen to connect, especially if you are in India, Southeast Asia, LATAM, please do hit me up on LinkedIn.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.